This is Jeffrey Edison, and I'm interviewing Rowan Harris in Highland, Illinois, at the Highland home. So, Mr. Harris, where are you from?
I'm from the little city of Alhambra, just 15 miles north of here.
How long were you living in Alhambra?
Well, until I got married in 1947. My residency was there, but I was actually working in Edwardsville at the Schneider Funeral Home from April of 1946 until we got married in June 17th of 1947. But I would go home on weekends or my days off.
What was it like growing up in Alhambra?
Well, it was small town, only about, 350 population. I think that's about what it was when I was growing up. So we had our own schoolhouse, a nice big schoolhouse that had been built in the middle 20s. And it was four rooms down and four rooms up. And then they fixed out the basement, half the basement, and started a high school in the basement of the building. And the other half is where they actually practiced basketball when it was winter. Other than that, we practiced on a clay court outside. We had softball, baseball, basketball, and tennis. Those are the four sports that the boys had. The girls had a couple of sports, they called it. I can't remember the names. They had some girl sports that they did. But I went through my junior year at Alhambra and then came in 1942-43. I came here to Highland. Went to senior year here in Highland. So it was small town atmosphere. You knew everybody, and everybody knew everything about everybody else, you know.
So what did you do for fun while living there?
Oh my. Well, I played at all sports from the time I was sixth grade. I was on the basketball and the softball team and all the way through high school there. Did 1 year of boxing, but I found out that I have a nose that bleeds very easily. So I would always wind up with a bloody nose, and so that took care of my boxing career. 1 year was enough. And we played in an old barn that was just next to our house. It was called a livery stable. It had the two wagons that the rural mail carriers used, and the man had the horses that he rented to the rural mail carriers so they could go out when the roads were impassable with a car. They would still take the old wagon and go with it, although I know the one gentleman left Alhambra at 9 o'clock in the morning and got home at 9 o'clock that night, when it was normally about a 3 hour run for him. So it took him 12 hours to do it that time. I don't know any other stories about that, but the old wagon happened to be the two buggies, I guess you'd call them, happened to be the place. That's our bell telling there's something going on down in the recreation room.
Well, the recorder will pick that up. Yeah.
We played a lot of kick the picket, which there was three. If there would be three of us, we'd be two against one, or you know, however the number. And then they'd go hide, and you could hide in the, because we would hide in the buggies sometimes, or we would hide in the hayloft, or, you know, just any place in the old barn, or out, even you could go around the barn. You could be on the outside of the barn, as long as you didn't go across the alley or across into our area. So we spent a lot of time playing kick the picket, and then the pickets got harder to get, and so then we started playing kick the tin can, you know. So then we got into playing softball, and then wiffle ball came along. That we could even play in our alley. We played wiffle ball a lot, because even if you hit a window, unless you really hit it hard, which we did occasionally, we would break a window and then have to chip in. Everybody would have to chip in and pay for the window glass and have the man at the lumber yard repair it for us. But we pretty well made our own games. We used sand in a canvas, an old canvas bag, or it had been a canvas covering. Our mothers sewed them up and made them into bases for our softball, and we would carry them around. We'd carry the four bases and set them in place and be able to play. I started roller skating when I was about 9 or 10, and then we had the Route 140 goes right through Alhambra, and the sidewalks were pretty good, but Route 40 was really great, and it wasn't a lot of traffic in those days, and you'd go down the opposite side of the road than what you actually drove on, so that you could watch the traffic and then be able to get off the road. Those were the big things. And then I started, my mother and dad danced a lot at the little fireman's hall we had. It was originally called Harmony Hall, because the harmoniers sang there originally. That's where it was started for. And then it became a little dance hall. It wasn't very big, but they danced a lot, and I used to have to sit on the chair and watch them, my brother and I. And the other people would bring their daughters, and we started dancing. I was dancing when I was 10 years old already. So that became a Saturday evening affair. They usually have they've sponsored one dance a month, at the hall, and then other people would have a wedding dance or anniversary dance or something, and everybody'd be invited, you know, and it didn't make any difference who it was. You could all come and have a good time. Usually share some cake and punch, but it wasn't hard to do something. You could always find somebody who was willing to do something. And we loved to go to the tower, which was just about a mile north of Alhambra. It's where the Illinois Central Railroad and the New York Central, the one that came out of Edwardsville, later called the Nickel Plate, Railroad crossed. There was a tower there that the tower man had to pull his big levers to move the track so they would go across or the other way. And that was a favorite hangout. Our neighbor on the other side of us, on the other side of the old barn, was the man that was there from 4 to midnight. And then he got to be the day man later on. But when we were younger, he was there from 4 to midnight. So we'd just walk out with him. He would walk that mile, usually. And we'd walk with him and stay till we got about 10 to 5. Time to head for home, you know, and take off on our... Sometimes we'd ride our bicycle out. Sometimes we'd walk. That was always a big thing, to watch the trains come and go. Watch what was in the train, and every once in a while you'd see a hobo uh, hanging on the back of one of the cars or inside an open car. And that was always, because in the city jail was at the other end of our block, in the back towards the north. The city jail was there. And the men would, the hobos would come, and they had two jail cells, and they had plastic covered, no, it wasn't plastic, I guess it was leather covered, cushions or that you could place on top of the metal. And there was a little pot-bellied stove, and the guys would come and cook their coffee and go out and beg for their food and then go back and eat it there. And we knew most of them by name. Most of them would come maybe in the spring, again in the fall. In the spring they'd be headed north, and in the fall when they came they'd be headed south. And they had got off the train because there was nothing to eat on the train, so they'd get off at the tower or the depot. And we got very good friends and never had any problem with any of them, because they all come to my mom's and she'd fix them a plate. They'd say, well, we'll take it back and eat it. And they'd sit on the porch while she was fixing it. That was always a big, you know, it was always something else extra to do. And our good friend then ran the filling station at the other end of our dad's block. My dad was a barber. He had his little barber shop there. And in those days, not many of the boys got haircuts at the barber shop. Mom and Pop cut their hair. A lot of the men got their hair cut there. But several of the older men, the banker, the postmaster, and one of our friends who was a carpenter, head carpenter, they would get shaved 3 times a week. Shaves those days was 10 cents. Haircuts was a quarter. And so there wasn't too many haircuts, because these older guys didn't need very much haircut. You know, it wouldn't grow too fast. But my dad would said, we're going to have to do something, because this was during the early or late Depression days. And so he started a little insurance agency. He got the Madison County Mutual Automobile Insurance Agency for our area. And that really helped us out. And then he got Hartford Insurance for home insurance. And it made a big difference in our lives. And I'll never forget, in 1936, he bought his first new car, 36 Ford four-door sedan, gray with red wheels. Can you imagine today, gray with red wheels? Well, that's what it was, 1936. Had the spare tire was in the back, hung on the back, because there was a trunk. Instead of putting the tire in the trunk, which would take up almost all the room because the trunk wasn't very big, they put the spare tire on the back. And that's what we drove up to New York in 1939 to go to the New York World's Fair. The biggest thing I ever had happen to me when I was a kid was going to, my dad had a friend here in Highland who had retired, a barber, and he had retired, and he came up and stayed at our place for 2 weeks, he and his wife, and lived at our place, in our house, and then ran the barber shop while we took this 2 weeks vacation, which was the very first vacation my father had ever taken. It was in 1939, we went to Washington, D.C. to meet a family up there who had lived in Alhambra originally. And then we went to New York City to the fair, and then we went to Niagara Falls and went up into Canada. We went up and came back in Toronto, Canada, and into Detroit and back home. 2 weeks we did all that. So we was moving. We only spent a day and a half at the fair because it was fairly expensive. Everything was expensive for us. But we certainly enjoyed it. I still have my souvenirs that I purchased all along the way. We'd buy a little something. I have a little box with all the souvenirs of the 1939 World's Fair. So, that answer your question pretty well? Thank you.
So you mentioned that you started school in Alhambra, but then you finished at Highland.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you end up going to Highland?
Well, Alhambra only had a three-year high school. All the small towns, St. Jacob, Marine, Alhambra, Warden, New Douglas, Sorrento, Panama, Witt, and Irving, they were all three-year high schools, and we had a league. We called it MBM, Madison Bond and Macoupin counties. And we played basketball and baseball and softball. Most of those schools didn't have tennis, but our school did have. And we played tennis against some of the schools down here in the Highland, south of Highland, like Trenton, and some of those smaller schools down there. My brother had also came here. He's 2 years older, and he came, and I had visited the school and enjoyed it. In fact, by that time, my aunt was teaching the fifth grade here. My father's youngest sister was teaching the fifth grade here, so it was a big incentive to get to see Aunt Vi. We enjoyed the school, and it was good for us. It got us going, and I liked math, and my brother did too. He became an accountant, and I went to 6 months of college. It was called Jefferson College. It was a division of Missouri University. It was in St. Louis. I got a job on the railroad when I graduated from high school that summer. I painted all the signals on the railroad, the Illinois Central Railroad, from Mont, which was south of Edwardsville, to almost to Mount Olive. And then I had my own hand car, a little gasoline-driven hand car that was rode on the railroad track. And in those days, we had little areas that we could pull off of, and we had to watch the signals to make sure there's no trains coming or going, and we could use that track to go to these different signals. And every signal then had a place for the little hand car. It was small, and you could lift it up like a wheelbarrow. It had handles on each end like a wheelbarrow has, and pull it off on the side under this little track. So I did that because I was only 17 when I graduated from high school, and I wasn't 18 until July, and by October the 15th I was in the service already. I was drafted, and I got into World War II. Was first at in Fort Sheridan in Chicago, and then I went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, I was in the field artillery. And the field artillery needed a lot of fellows who had math too, because of all the calibrations on the gun was done mathematically by up in your head or on paper as you were using the 105 howitzer, which is what I was in. So I was an acting corporal during my first 16 weeks. And then I was able to go to what they called cadre school, which was a school to be what we called a non-commissioned officer. And when I graduated from that after 16 weeks, I became a corporal. Then I taught the 105 howitzer and gymnastics for 16 weeks as a corporal. Then the next 16 weeks of training for the recruits, I was a sergeant, and then that, at the end of that 16 weeks, I took those fellows that were in my unit overseas with us. We went to Fort Ord, California, and then over to San Francisco, got on a boat, and we were waiting for a convoy, so we sat off of Hawaii. We could see Hawaii off in the north, but we couldn't, never did get there. We sat there for 5 days, just going around in circles, waiting for the convoy to take shape. Then we had 32 ships when we finally got all together that went from there to New Caledonia, which is an island between Australia and New Zealand. It makes a little triangle. And we picked up the outfit that we were going to be assigned to. We went as recruits, as with what we called replacements. And we were assigned to this 98th Field Artillery Battalion, which we took. Then we left there after 2 months and went to Leyte in the Philippine Islands, Leyte Island. We landed in Leyte Gulf off of a troop ship. We had a troop ship that had was built for 4,000 troops, and instead of having 4,000, we had 8,000 troops, which meant that we had to be up on deck or in the lower decks from 6 in the morning to 6 at night while somebody slept in our hammock down below. And then that evening we were in down below from 6 to 6. And I had learned to play bridge in the meantime with when I was at Fort Ord. And the first sergeant said, we're going to need you. I said, well, you got four. But he said, well, we're going to need five, because he said, we're always going to be one in the chow line. And that's exactly what happened. We laid on our bellies playing bridge under our trucks for shade. And one of us was always, whoever started a breakfast line, time he ate and got back and all four of us had eaten, then it was his job to start for lunch. Time the four of us got eaten again, it was time for him to go for his evening meal. We'd finish that. So there was always four playing bridge, and you never played with the same partner because you always change partners as you played. We'd play four hands, and then we changed partners. You kept your own score because you were always playing with somebody different. And so I had a little book of 20 pages, a book, very thick, fit in my shirt pocket. That's how big it was. Today, the bridge book is 198 pages, and it's a regular paperback type book. So that's how bridge has changed. There's so many new rules and what you call we call conventions and things. Bridge. And I have been teaching bridge here in Highland since 1970. About every 2 years I have a class of what we call beginner class and then an intermediate class. But that's getting a little ahead of my story. But anyhow, like I said, I went in as a replacement, and by the time we got there, the Japanese had pulled out of Leyte entirely. The ships couldn't get it back in. There was about 2,000 Japanese soldiers still on Leyte. About 980 of them actually brought out with their white flags, became prisoners. But the other guys decided they weren't going to do that. They were, you know, the Japanese had their own theories, and so they didn't. So it was our job then as field artillery to blast them out of these caves. We were over on the west side, then we landed on the east side. We were over by Ormoc on the west side. There was some caves similar to the area which you see around Collinsville, there's the bluffs, they call it, and that's all limestone. Well, that's what was there. But there had been some little caves in the area, and they made a big cave out of it. They dug out from the inside, and that's one of the things we did. We got some shells right inside that cave, which you couldn't see. The cave went down into the ground, but we were able to get the shell to go down into that hole, and then they wiped out all the... A lot of them by that time knew what was coming. We were moving on, and they could see us. We couldn't see them, but they could see us. And they knew what was coming. A lot of them did surrender, but I don't know exactly how many were killed, but it was a large number that was killed in that was 2 weeks of actual duty that we had. So the rest of the time then I went, the minute the atomic bomb was dropped, I was on my way to Manila. We had some casualties. We had one man killed in our outfit, and I helped the medics, because my thought was, when I was in school originally, that I would become a funeral director and embalmer. In high school and the like, I took aeronautical engineering and thought I would be an aeronautical engineer. Well, that didn't happen, because when I came home, Curtis Wright and McDonald's was laying off all their engineers. They didn't need them anymore. So I went back to being a funeral director. But let's get back to what I did right after the atomic bomb was dropped. I went up to Manila and was stationed at the number one station hospital in Manila, right on Rizal Avenue, which was the main street in Manila. They put up 3 barracks buildings, and we were living on the second floor, and down below we were interviewing all the American prisoners who had been in Japan. As they were bringing them back, their first stop was Manila. They would fly them that far. And then they would come to the hospital, and if they were able to walk or come in a wheelchair, they would come to us, which is what I did for the first 3 weeks. I couldn't sleep. The stories I heard of the atrocities that they did to the American prisoners. So fortunately, the gentleman who was with us, the first sergeant, he had enough time in that he got to go home, and I was able to take his place. By that time, I was a staff sergeant, so I took his place. I never was made a first sergeant, but I did first sergeant's duty. So I got to assign the fellows to do the jobs instead of actually doing the job, and that was a different story entirely. I had my own Jeep, and every weekend, we would just do this Monday through Friday, and every weekend I could go take some of my buddies and we would go to different areas. We had buddies who were in other camps and the like, and we would get to go to where they were and see part of the country. So we got up all the way to Subic Bay and Baguio and places to the airports. So it was, I didn't leave the Philippines until April 1st of 1946, because I was not married. I had time in service counted, 1 month counted as a point, and you had to have so many points before you could get back. And your time overseas counted 2 points, every month counted 2 points. So it took a while for me to get enough points to get back to the United States. And I had a girlfriend back here who I had been writing to, and when I had my 2 furloughs, we had dates, and I figured, so I asked my mom and dad to bring her along to meet us at Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, when I was discharged on Easter Sunday of April the 21st, 1946. And they brought her along, and June the 17th, 1947, we got married. And we've been married 69 years. We'll be 70 years in this coming June. So it's been a whirlwind. I started working at the funeral home in Edwardsville on May the 1st of 1946. Worked there till September of 1948. And then I came here to Highland and worked for Tibbetts & Company, which is a furniture store and a funeral home. In 1950, the gentleman who owned the business, Mr. Tibbetts, had a heart attack, and I started managing the store for him. And then he let me buy, that year he let me buy 20% of the business. And then by the end of the year, I had 40% of the business, and then I could buy 49% of the business, and then when he retired completely, I was able to buy 100% of the business, and I kept the furniture store for a number of years, and then I bought an old banker's big three-story brick home, started my funeral home over there, made a larger furniture store, had to have a manager there, had to have a manager at the funeral home, and I was putting out more money than I was making, so I decided to stay in the funeral business, which is what I knew best, and did that for the next 30 years. And when I retired from the funeral business, and a friend of mine, who our neighbor, said, "Raleigh, you ought to get into our public relations department at the bank where I work." So I only worked 14 more years in the public relations department at the First National Bank here in Highland. So I can't sit still, as you know. Right now I'm starting a museum here, and we'll have time after a while to go up and see what's going on. But I collected what we called Highland memorabilia. From 1950, I started collecting this memorabilia. And when we moved here, I moved 98 boxes of Highland memorabilia that I had in my basement at home. And we sorted it all out. We got it down to 44 boxes. It's all in alphabetical order. A, B, C, on down, and all the little towns around us also have a box. So we're starting to fill up the first room. We have four rooms upstairs in the old part, the part of the home that was built in 1912. In 1912, when the home was built, there was 14 rooms downstairs with a men's bathroom at the south end of the room, and a ladies' bathroom at the north end of this big building, and a long hallway, and then the same thing up on the second floor. So it housed 28 people, and each one had their own room and a closet and a window, and that was and a door going out into the hallway, and that was about it. And then the men had to go down to the south end and use the bathroom. One bathtub, one basin, one stool in the men's room, same thing in the ladies' room. So when I was asked to come on the board here in 1956, I was asked to come on the board, be a member of the board. There was 10 people on the board. And one of the first things I started talking about is putting some additions onto this building, and we're in that first edition. The first edition went north out of the basement of the home. When you'll see that the quarters are on a hill, and this is coming out of that hill, we would have had to really put a big area in here. So instead we used it as the quarters themselves. And then we have two more wings that we made out. One goes to the west and one goes to the southwest. So we, right now we have 28 rooms in use. We have five or six rooms that are not in use, but we have three people that are coming in. So we'll be in pretty good shape again very shortly. So we love it here. We've been here since December the 10th of last year. And we love it here. They took three single rooms here in this unit here and made one big apartment out of it. They did that last year, and when they started doing it, we'd been here 2 years before that and looked, but in those days they just had a two-room apartment, and the wife and I figured it was just too small for us. So when they started making the two three-room apartments out of these single rooms, we were told that they were doing that, and we came up right away and looked and saw to see what they were doing. That was in October. And the time they got it all ready and the like, we moved in on the 10th of December. So we really love it here. Our meals are furnished. Our food is great. We have good cooks. We have people here in the building 24 hours a day. They do our own cleaning of our room. They change our bed once a week. They do our washing and ironing. Washing and ironing, yes. And they do a great job. The people here that work here are just, they're dedicated to the Highland senior citizens, and they do a wonderful job for us. Couldn't be better. I didn't think I'd say that. We built our own house 23 years ago. We built our own house, and we said that's where we were going to stay. But wife broke her left ankle three times, and it's just as the last time we also tore the ligament. And so standing is things she can't do. So it was just too much standing at home, cooking and ironing and washing. So she does very well here now. So what else do you need?
So you mentioned that you started the museum part of this home.
Yes.
What interests you about Highland history and like Madison County history?
Well, history was my second favorite class. Mathematics was the first and history was the second. And being in World War II like I was, we had so much interaction with the other people, which was history. And we started a historical society in 1971 here in Highland. And I was the first president. Six of us started it, and within a year we had 200 members, and we tried to save the old Swiss residence barn that was built just north of Highland. It had needed a new roof, and we got that on the east side. The west side we had it half on. And we did that in the first year that we had it. And we had the new roof on the opening on the west side. And in December of 14th of 1971, there was a tornado here in Highland. And it just took that half of the east section and moved it to almost 200 feet, almost up to the house of the farm. Took the west section of that roof and threw it about 30 feet to the west. Can you imagine? One went to the east, one section went to the west, turned the barn a foot and a half on its foundation, so we couldn't save it anymore. And so that ended. We thought maybe that ended the Historical Society, but it didn't. We got other projects going. We redid the chapel out at the cemetery. We were then given the Lotzer Homestead, which Louis Lotzer was the founder of the Pet Milk Company. It was here in Highland. It started here in Highland in 1885. They gave us his home and farm, 40 acres of ground. And we have what we call harvest days still out there. We have steam engines come and old cars, old tractors, And we have 3 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the second weekend in September. And we make enough money to take care of the buildings, and with the income from about 25 acres that we still farm, we get crops, and we get the one-third of the crop price. So with that, we're able to take care of this farm. Then we were also given the old stagecoach stop, which is a old brick building, and we fixed it all up, and that is the Historical Society Museum. And I gave a lot of things to them when they started, and it is full. There's no room for anything else. So that's the reason we started this museum here. I had these 98 boxes, which are now 44 boxes, which we've gone from, we're in O right now. We're doing the O through Z boxes because that's the room that's ready. So we have to, it's the farthest one to the south. So we're starting there. We'll have four rooms in the old part, plus the hallway, which is the entire length of the building. That's going to be an art museum. And then the north end of that building is going to be, we're calling it the farm room building, the north farm room building. And it's going to have we started out asking for centennial farms, but we find out there aren't that many centennial farms in the area. There is even a couple of sesquicentennial farms in the area. But we're asking anybody in the area that wants to put in pictures, if they'll frame them, we'll put them up. So I have 9 other people who have said they're going to bring things. I have 18 other people who have already brought things for us to put in there. So we're going to be fairly close to saying hold off until we get these all up to see if we're going to have more room. But it's a work in progress. We started this in April, and here we are, well, in October, and we're just starting to get it, putting mint on the shelves. All the shelving that I had at home, I brought up here, and they're putting, the men that work here are putting plexiglass in frames in front of these shelves now, and then with doors so that we can get into them. So it's really going to be very nice when we get it all done. And my wife used to call it my Highland junk. Now she definitely calls it my Highland memorabilia. And she worked at the box company here in Highland for over 20 years. And she was the first computer operator they had. And she was on the computer the rest of the time. So she has her own computer and her own pad. Can't even say the name. But anyhow, she has her little pad that she does. And now we've bought another little computer. She has 1,400 and some odd things already entered on the computer, and tells who gave it, if somebody gave it other than myself. Because when I had the funeral home, I had big cabinets built up there in the one room, and people started bringing things in. And I had a booklet. I had over 100 names in that book of people who had brought things in. And so we're listing their name on the item that they brought in. So it's going to be a lot of grandchildren have never seen the items, you know, that grandma and grandpa gave, or their dad and mom gave. And we're going to have it on display, and it's going to show their number and their name on the item. So it's going to create a lot of activity. The schools, I know both the history teachers at St. Paul and at Highland and at the middle school, and they're going to have their classes come whenever it's ready. It'll be next year, won't be this year anymore. But that's what we're planning on doing. One of my hobbies, besides collecting all this Highland junk, was I took up art in 1990 when I retired. I figured I needed a hobby, which I really didn't, but I took up art, and I've painted a little over 100 pictures in the years. And now I'm basically painting I've painted our son's homes on canvas, and now I'm painting the grandchildren's home on canvas. I really enjoy that. I have several of my pictures are up here in the art museum, because I spent a lot of time out at Silver Lake painting scenes out there, and I've got two of those in the museum up here. And also the one of the old barn that we tried to save, the Swiss barn. How are we doing on time?
Doing fine, go ahead.
Okay, all right. What else you need to know?
I'm interested in, like, what are your favorite parts of History for Highland and this side of Madison County? What do you enjoy most learning about Highland?
Well, the Lotzer Homestead is a big 12-room house frame sitting in just a mile and a half south of town here. He was a farmer. He was a milker. And so when they started with the idea of starting a milk factory here, he was all for it. He became one of the directors, and one of ten directors. And he had gone to McKendree College in Lebanon 1 year and took up chemistry. And his father returned to Europe and didn't come back. He just went over for a visit, but never returned. So he had to quit college and come back and run the farm. He had a younger brother who was 4 years younger, and so he was still in school, in high school, and so he came back to run the farm, and like I say, he kept on milking. The original barn is still out there. The house, the original house set right beside the barn, which was the Swiss-German way of doing things. The house and the barn were very close. Because in the bad weather, you didn't have so far to go, you know. They only had about 14, 15 feet from the barn to the house. So they didn't get very wet, or they didn't get much snow, you know, to get to the barn. And that original barn is still there. The original barn has a big hayloft, and the big hayloft was used for many, many things, and I'll tell you what else it was used for. It was used to house the miniature pet milk factory that was a miniature of the Greenville, Illinois plant in 1941. They built it all out of stainless steel and what they called graniteware, which is a metal with porcelain over the top, and that unit weighs 3 ton, that'd be 6,000 pounds. It's 26 foot long and 8 foot high, and has motors and pumps and everything in it to make the thing work. That all was stored in the hayloft of that red barn after 1987, when Highland had its sesquicentennial. The Pet Milk Company stored it in the barn there. They had it on display at the exhibition hall here in Highland. Then when they took it down, put it back into the 17 wooden crates, they had no place to go with it, and we offered them they could have the hayloft if they would distribute it along in the hayloft, over the whole hayloft, not stack it, but put it one layer high. They did. Then Pet Milk was sold to IC Industries in 1977, and the IC Industries didn't know anything about this being in the hayloft. So we wrote IC Industries, asked them what we should do with this miniature pet milk factory that we had. They said they knew nothing about it, that we should write and tell them about it, and they would give us some ideas. So we didn't open it because it was in wooden crates and nobody opened it. Took pictures of the crates, sent it up to IC Industries. They said, well, you have it, you own it, if you'll take care of it. We said, we'll take care of it. So we took the old pole barn and took 1/4 of the pole barn and made it the area for the miniature pet milk factory. Two of the men on the board, who are very well mechanics, set it all up and got it all running. Had to put all new belts and pulleys and everything on it. They did all that. And it's been, well, this year was the 19th year that we've had it up and running. So we'll be celebrating our 20th year of the miniature factory running. And it's a sight to behold. It's all 32nd gauge, like railroads, called 32nd scale. Everything's, even the little men that were standing around doing different things, we still have. They've had to be new clothes put on them, but they took the old clothes and made clothes exactly the same as close as we could get the same type of material. So it's something to see. And that's one of my jobs, that Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I give tours of the museum. It's a half-hour tour. And Bill Alexander, one of the other men, and Jim Gifford, who now is the manager here of the building manager. He was the other man who did it. They start up the factory every year and have it running again. But Bill Alexander and myself, we take turns. If I talk for 20 minutes, I need to rest a little bit. So we do that from 8 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. So it gets to be a big job. So
So, one more question for you.
Okay.
So, I've read that you do some articles on the Highland News Leader.
Oh, yes.
So, what caught your interest in doing history articles for the Highland News Leader?
Well, that has a story in all its own. Jules Spindler, who was the president of the Farmers and Merchants Bank, during World War II, wrote letters, his secretary wrote letters to all the servicemen that would write them a letter. He put it in the paper. You write me a letter, tell me where you are, give me your address, and we'll send you a letter. Well, then the newspaper decided that would be a good thing to put these letters in the newsletter, the paper that I write for today. And so they gave him a whole page of the paper for him to put his letters in. Well, that got to be good advertisement for the Farmers and Merchants Bank, but also good advertising for the people who were overseas. Other people didn't even know they were overseas. Here they are, overseas. That was his first. They had to be overseas originally, and then it didn't have to be that later on. But and so all the while the war was going on, he was getting these letters. And he was writing then a column to go with this. So he'd have a little column in the paper. And it was about something about Highland. He retires and moves out to California. And he's a Dale Carnegie teacher out there in California. And he actually became the state of California chairman for Dale Carnegie courses. And then he retires, comes back to Highland again. We had played bridge with him before they left. We played bridge with him again when they came back. And we're sitting there one evening playing bridge, and he said, Raleigh, I got something for you. I said, oh, what you got for me, Jewel? He said, you're going to start writing a column in the paper He said, I talked to the news leader and they're willing to do it. He said, you got to take up all this Highland history stuff. I said, well, my great-great-grandfather, the three greats, great-great-grandfather, was here before the Swiss, so I guess I am really capable of taking on this job. He said, yeah, your grandpa, great-great-grandpa James Reynolds had a farm out here, and the Swiss had their first meal with him. And I said, yep, that's right. That's the way it came down to me from my aunt, who was the genealogist of our family. And I said, I've always been interested in that. He said, you got to start writing. So that's what I did. This is, I think, my 23rd or 24th year that I've been writing articles for the news leader about Highland history. And I'm only up to World War I right now in all the writings. I started out in the early 1800s, 1804, when the first people came to the area, and then when my great-grandfather came in 1818, when the Illinois was made a state, he came to this area, but then he settled first around St. Jacob. And then he bought this farm in what we call Saline Township. And he had 160 acres, which in those days was a tremendous big farm. 40 acres, most of the people had 40 acres, and they had a hard time taking care of that. But he had two grown sons and two grown daughters. And so the sons and the daughters all built homes around the area. And so they actually did the farming. He did the butchering and things like that, but they did most of the farming. So, and he and his wife and the one daughter fed the Swiss, the party of 15 Swiss that came to Highland on October the 15th of 1831. They came and they had their dinner meal with the Reynolds family. So. I've always enjoyed history and genealogy, and I had an aunt, Aunt Alberta Meebold from Marine, who her husband was the postmaster over there, that got me interested in our family history, and she had all the things on the Blakeman side, also the other side. They came here from England and came right to a Marine. They were the ones who he was a sea captain, and he actually was one of the three men that started Marine. They were mariners, so they called the little town Marine. And they started what was called Marine Settlement in 1819. He came, and they started that area. Then the town of Marine was started about a mile and a half or almost 2 miles north of that. It was a better area than the area that they started for the 1818, Illinois became a state, and that's when they could start selling land. But there was people here that lived here before that. Well, those people got the first chance to buy. So they would, the Blakemans, when they came, and the other sea captains that came, could only buy little pieces here and there, sort of like a patchwork quilt. The area that was around Marine had already been purchased. And so even though it was a little better area, they bought this area south of Marine. And that Marine Cemetery that's on the Marine St. Jacob Road is where he gave the Blakeman, my great-great-grandfather, three greats again, grandfather, gave the land for the Union Church and cemetery, which was next to his, just south of his farm, on the Marine St. Jacob, or on the St. Jacob Marine Road. So I do have ties on from 1819 to 1830. Reynolds settled here in 1830. So I guess I'm almost a Highland native, you'd say.
Well, thank you very much for your time today. It was very thoughtful, and I appreciate you talking to me. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure.